Uh-oh. Guess what day it is? Guess what day it is? Huh? Anybody?
Julie, hey, guess what day it is?
Oh, come on. I know you can hear me. Mike. What day is it, Mike? Leslie, guess what today is?
It's Rusev Day!
Rusev Day!
Yes!
It's business time, baby.
The Solar Monster sounds off.
My client!
Mama Monster!
Conquered the street!
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat!
You haven't been beat up properly!
Woo! Happy Rusev Day! It is Sunday, December 10, 2017. I am the Solar Monster, and this is episode 525 of the Solar Monster Sounds Off. And after all this talk for months now about how this India tour is coming up, which, by the way, wasn't much of a tour, it was really two dates, which turned into one date after they couldn't sell enough tickets to both shows. But WWE finally had its big India Super Show yesterday with Jinder Mahal's homecoming in the main event against Triple H. Triple H lost to Roman Reigns the night before in Abu Dhabi, but he was too much for the Maharaja to overcome. Yes, Triple H pinned Jinder Mahal in India. Not a surprise, not in the least, but still, I laughed when I read that. Now, he did let him kick out of a pedigree, which not anybody does, although plenty of people have kicked out of a pedigree, but he let him kick out of one, so it's not like he didn't give him anything. You know, he put him over after the match, he danced with him after the match, but after all that, Jinder could not even get a win in his gimmicked home country. And we know what happens when you wrestle in your hometown in WWE, but I guess my question would be, does it count if it's only your gimmicked hometown? Like, you know, do the same rules apply? I don't know. You know, does that WWE rule of losing in your hometown still apply if it's a fake hometown? I guess it does, at least in this case. Hopefully that spells the end of Jinder Mahal in these main events, at least on TV. I have no problem with the guy being on the show. I just have no interest in seeing him in pay-per-view main events. We have one more left. That's next Sunday, him and AJ Styles. With AJ in the match, I suspect that he's going to have the best shot at having maybe the best pay-per-view match that he's had all year. And Jinder's had a whole bunch. You know, he's had a few with Randy Orton. He's had a few with Nakamura. None of them were particularly good. Especially the Nakamura ones were very disappointing. Didn't even wrestle at Survivor Series. I suspect this will be his final pay-per-view main event. At least for a while, and we'll see how he does. But we got one more match to go, and then hopefully we can move on from the Jinder stuff as far as the championship is concerned. We have a lot to get into here, including breaking news, big story that broke overnight concerning the arrest of a WWE star. Talk about bad timing, considering who it is. But before we get to all that, quick plug to Audible, audible.com. We are in the final weeks of 2017, we've had an incredible year in terms of the number of signups. I want to end on a high note, and I want you guys to get a free book before the year is out. So use our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. You plug that link in, you have to sign up. You sign up for the 30-day trial. You can sample the service for a month. You do not get billed unless you go beyond the 30 days. If you love it so much you want to keep it, by all means do so. It's a great service. But if you don't want to, you get to keep one free book that comes as part of your trial. And it could be any wrestling book. It could be any non-wrestling book. And there are a ton of wrestling books on there. A lot of good ones, too. So if you want the Daniel Bryan book, Chris Jericho, Shawn Michaels, Bob Holly's book is on there, Justin Roberts, The Death of WCW, Jim Ross, which is narrated by JR, on and on and on. Use our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. It is free. As far as the free book as part of the trial, that does not cost you a thing, so go ahead and take advantage of that before the year is over. Also, if you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. I'm reading things about Patreon this week, because I think I've mentioned before, you know, that I've been considering for a while now, at some point soon, possibly setting up a page and just figuring out what I'd be able to offer and how it would work. But I've been reading, apparently there's a A lot of people very upset with changes that were made to the fee structure of Patreon, and people are fleeing. I don't know what's going on there. Maybe somebody who's more up to speed on that can fill me in, but now I'm having second thoughts about that. I'm going to kind of lay back and see what the fallout from all of this is, but that was an interesting story this week. I saw a lot of angst, a lot of anger towards Patreon, but you can make a PayPal donation as always. That never changes. Just go to thesolemnmonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. Thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, two of the biggest members of our family here, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, the Florida Freebird Bryant Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Mass Grave Micah Harshaw, Luis Hercules Hernandez, Raymond the Mountie Medina, who was without water, electricity, and internet for 86 days after Hurricane Maria, and just now got all three things back, which I'm very happy to hear, and I'm happy that that you're safe. And I know there's a lot of people still in Puerto Rico. According to Raymond, it's upwards of 70% who still don't have a lot of those things, which is insane to think about, but I'm glad that Raymond is okay. Money Maxwell McTaggart, who turned 5 this week. Yes, 5 years old. So happy birthday, Max. I hope you got some nice gifts. Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, aim for the head. And by the way, I don't think Max actually sent that email. Actually, I know he didn't. Although that would be funny if I start getting emails from five-year-olds wanting PayPal shoutouts. I do them for all ages, so it's all good for me. Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, aim for the head. Andrew Jorlog, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T. The Chin Crusher Karsten Axe. Brett Brickfist Brode. Max the Axe Velado, the DC Slayer Marcus Cross, the Show-Off Corey Van Dam, the God of Justice Giovanni Turner, John More Money More Problems Morin, Clayton Creepy Uncle. Yes, the Creepy Uncle has contributed once again, so shout out to Clayton. Gabriel the San Diego Beer Snob Solis, who celebrated a birthday on Friday. So happy birthday to the Beer Snob. The Columbus Destroyer, John Sterniker, who also celebrated a birthday this week, the same day as Dean Ambrose, in fact. So happy birthday to John and to Dean Ambrose, who I'm sure is listening right now. No, he's not. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Dennis This Means War Walton, Paul Bulletproof Bradshaw, The Wolf, Jay Patel, your boy Deluxman, who just did a video on his YouTube channel called Roman Reigns, What Fans Want Versus What Corporate Wants, which is a little comedy sketch that he put together. I call it a little comedy sketch. I mean, he put a lot of work into this thing. I got to give him a big shout out for that. So go ahead and check that out. It's up on his YouTube channel right now. And also, I want to show some love to ProWrestlingLinks.com. It is your one-stop shop for links to all of the important wrestling websites and podcasts that you will ever need. So, ProWrestlingLinks.com. For those of you who have asked me, I don't know when the cutoff is for the Wrestling Radio Awards nominations. I know that whole thing is still open. So if you either haven't done so, or you know, if you want to continue to do so, you can vote once a day, every day. It's entirely up to you. But if you go to WrestlingRadioAwards.com, you can write in Solemonster Sounds Off under Show of the Year, and more importantly, under Male Interview of the Year. I want to show some love to a couple of the interviews I did this year. The one with Dave Lagana, who's one of the people sort of overseeing things right now with the relaunched NWA, along with Billy Corgan. They're doing some fun stuff there. I spoke to him. We had over an hour-long conversation back in March about a whole lot of things. And I enjoyed that, as I did my interview in July with Justin Roberts about the ins and outs of working in WWE. So if you want to write in one or both, you know, maybe on alternate days of those interviews, you could fill that in under Male Interview of the Year. And you could check both of them out. They're up on YouTube right now. We start with breaking news. Overnight, WWE 205 Live star Rich Swann, who, as fate would have it, is scheduled to wrestle Drew Gulak on Raw tomorrow night to determine a new number one contender for the Cruiserweight title. You know, I actually have a lot of sympathy for WWE on this because Rich Swann has been part of the Cruiserweight division since day one. He's a former Cruiserweight champion. He used to get more face time on Raw than he does, although he is, you know, he's I think he's still on TV often enough. But how long has it been since Rich Swann was in any kind of a featured match, a featured singles match on Raw? It's been a long time. Of all weeks for this to happen, this guy is in one of the featured, promoted matches on Raw tomorrow night. And then they got to wake up on Sunday morning, the day before, and read this. So I actually sympathize with WWE on this. And obviously that match is going to be changed. Ain't no way that match is happening tomorrow night. I don't know if they're going to let him go right away, if they're going to wait pending the results of an investigation to see what happens. Because, you know, there are situations where charges are dropped, and then it's kind of a weird thing, you know, if you let the guy go, but charges are dropped, you know, what happens then? Is it, you know, does he have a case for wrongful termination? I don't know how quickly WWE is going to want to act in that way. These are pretty serious charges here. He was arrested early this morning in Gainesville, Florida. He was charged with battery, which is a first-degree misdemeanor, carries up to a year in jail, and the more serious charge of kidnapping slash false imprisonment, which, if convicted, carries a penalty of up to 5 years in prison. Now, as I am recording this, WWE has not released a statement, nor have they wished him well in his future endeavors, although given the charges, I think if they do end up firing him, I doubt they're going to be wishing him well in anything. And we'll see. As I record this show, I'm going to be recording probably for the next 2 hours. If that changes and they put a statement out, I'll read it here on the show. But it's too early in the morning, nothing from them yet. Now, I believe, you know, his wife wrestles as Sue Young. She is an independent wrestler. I believe she was wrestling at a show in Gainesville last night. And so I read that and I'm thinking, okay, well, you put two and two together, it's quite likely that she was involved in this. And then right before I started recording, the Gainesville Police Department, who I guess is being inundated with requests for information and the police report, they finally posted the police report online. They put it in a Dropbox. I have the police report here, and I've read part of it. I have not read the whole thing, but I've read part of it. I'm going to read it right now, because I think it sheds a lot more information on what happened here. So this is directly from the police report. It was just released within the last 30 minutes. This is what the report says. It says that on the above date and time, the victim and the defendant were, the defendant being Rich Swann, were engaged in an argument. Both the victim and the defendant are professional wrestlers, and the victim had just put on a show in downtown Gainesville. The defendant was critiquing the victim's performance and began getting angry with her. The victim got scared that the argument was going to escalate and got out of the car in the area of, and then they give the area. The defendant stopped his vehicle in the middle of traffic, and the victim jumped out of the car. The defendant gave chase and yelled for the victim to get back into the car. The victim told the defendant that she did not want to get back into the car as she continued to walk away. The defendant then grabbed the victim by her arm and then around her neck with his arm. He placed her in a headlock and dragged her back into their vehicle. The victim screamed for help as the defendant pushed her in the car. Witness number one, because there were a couple of witnesses to this, witness number one observed this happen, called the, the police department. The witness said that she saw the defendant chase after the victim and put her in a headlock and shove her back into the car while she screamed for help. Said that the victim was beating on the window, screaming for help as they drove away again. The witness said that the victim seemed very afraid of the defendant and was trying to get away from him. The second witness observed the vehicle driven by the defendant driving erratically. Witness then saw the victim jump out of the car while it was moving and run away. Witness saw the defendant get out of the car while it was still moving and chase after the victim. The car was not in park and continued to roll until it hit a telephone pole. So he's lucky that he didn't hit somebody with this car. The victim stated that she was afraid of the defendant because he has a temper sometimes. She said that she was trying to get away from him because he was scared, or she was scared, that their argument would escalate into physical violence. The victim said that the defendant grabbed her by the arm and pulled her back into the car even though she did not want to go with him. She said that she told the defendant to pull over so she could get out, but he refused and she ended up jumping out of the vehicle while it was still slowly moving. Post-Miranda rights here, the defendant stated that he did not grab the victim and put her in the car. The defendant stated that she got into the car on her own and he never physically touched her. The defendant said that he was just trying to get home and she had the phone with the GPS on it, so he needed her to come with him. The victim and the defendant have been in a relationship for approximately 5 years and have been married for 9 months. So that is the police report, and I guess without saying so and confirming things, obviously it is his wife, it is Soo Young that they're talking about here. He claims he didn't do what he is alleged to have done, but there's two witnesses that say otherwise, so he's in a lot of trouble. He is in a lot of trouble. And, you know, it's really sad considering that great story of redemption that they told about this guy when he first came in, you know, the Cruiserweight Classic, and then when he debuted on TV, I remember they put together that great video package for him, and they talked about his parents dying young and all the hardships that he had when he was a lot younger, and now he finally made it, and he's the Cruiserweight champion, and it was this great story, and he's always got a smile on his face. He ain't got no smile on his face here in this mugshot photo. Might be the first time I've ever seen this guy without a smile on his face, because he knows that he's in a lot of trouble. So, question now is, what do you do tomorrow night? First of all, if I'm WWE, I mean, I understand the need to wait and sort of let things play out, but this is potentially just a PR nightmare for them, having somebody like this associated with them, under contract to them. At the very least, I suspend the guy. I think the fair thing to do would be just to suspend him without pay until this stuff gets worked out. And tomorrow night, you know, they love their multi-man matches, and so I would book another one, because why not? I'd book another multi-man match with a bunch of cruiserweights to open the show tomorrow night and have the winner of that match face Drew Gulak in a singles match later on in the show. And I think this might be a really good spot to debut Hideo Itami. Now, they've already been running video packages for him, coming soon, vignettes for him. He's coming in. It's just a matter of which week. I'd bump that up and have him debut tomorrow night, and I'd put him over. I'd have him win the multi-man match. I'd have him beat Drew Gulak, and I'd have him be the one to challenge Enzo Amore next for the Cruiserweight title. You know, that's probably the biggest way to make a splash with this guy. So that's what I would do, but I suspect that those conversations right now are ongoing with Vince McMahon and his writing staff, who I'm sure are just absolutely enthusiastic about being woken up this morning with this news and having to make all these changes to the show at the last minute. But that's probably something, honestly, that they should be used to by now. So that's the update on Swan. You know, again, company does not take matters of domestic violence lightly, so he will be punished. How extreme, we'll find out probably in a few hours, and we'll see what they end up doing tomorrow night. I'll talk more about 205 Live and 205 Live house shows now, all that stuff when I get to the Raw review in a little bit. USA Today reported this week that Ronda Rousey is close to finalizing her move to WWE, which has been in the works for a number of months now, probably the world's worst-kept secret that Ronda would be doing something with WWE, if not signing with them. She has been training to wrestle. It just sounded like a formality that it would be made official. Assuming that they are still doing the horsewomen against horsewomen match at WrestleMania, which has been rumored for months now, here's how I think you do it, now that Ronda is this close to actually signing with the company. I think you got to have a big press conference to announce her signing. That's number one. I mean, that just goes without saying, right? She's still a huge star. I know she hasn't won a fight in a while, but in fact, I think I saw Dana White the other day saying that he hopes she doesn't come back. He was almost talking about her like she's, I hope she doesn't come back. It's for her own sake. Like she's on the verge of you know, like one concussion more or something is going to like ruin her life. I don't know what that was all about. Although she hasn't looked good in her last, you know, her last fight or two, so maybe it's just concern for how she's looked in her fights, but I don't know, I thought he was being a little overdramatic in some of the comments that I saw him making. But she's still a huge star. The point is, she's still a big name, she's still a huge star, and you want to milk that for all that it's worth. And this would actually get real media people at a press conference, not like some of the staged press conferences that they've done over the years, although I am still a very big fan of the press conference they had to announce Ric Flair's challenger for the WWF title at WrestleMania 8, when Jack Tunney announced Hulk Hogan, and Sid just loses his shit. Remember that whole, like, they had the dais where Tunney's in the middle at the podium, you got Hogan and Savage and Sid on one side, you have Piper and Undertaker, and I think somebody else on the other side, And as soon as Sid's like, all right, it's all me. And then Hogan stands up and Sid just loses his mind. But with all eyes on this press conference, you have not only Ronda's pals there, like, you know, Shayna Baszler and the other two women. You've got Charlotte, let's say, in attendance. Sasha, Becky, some of the other WWE women are also there. Just the company rolling out the red carpet for this woman. Ronda could talk a big talk. I mean, Ronda can talk. We know that. And let's say that she's talking and it just happens to rub some of the women the wrong way. I'm not saying they have to come to blows at the press conference or anything like that. Honestly, I would save that for TV. I'm thinking along the lines of that first Austin Mike Tyson confrontation on Raw back in 98. And, you know, it's tough now because you have the brand split. Sasha and Bayley are on Raw. Charlotte and Becky are on SmackDown. But to follow up on the press conference, I think you need to have her either on Raw or, you know, SmackDown that week, whenever the press conference is. You have her in the ring with Stephanie on Raw that Monday, or you have her in the ring with Shane McMahon on SmackDown that Tuesday for an interview. Maybe they could even have a bidding war. You know, you could have a bidding war between the two brands, between Shane and Stephanie for the rights, for the services of Ronda Rousey. Point is, they should do something on one of those shows where a big brawl breaks out with her and her crew, and let's say Charlotte and Becky on SmackDown. You want to make it crystal clear that there is still, you know, heat there stemming from their little confrontation. If you remember back at the Mae Young Classic tapings, they didn't come to blows or anything, but there was a little bit of a stare down between the two groups, and then it was never spoken of again. That's where the seed was planted for all this. But I think Ronda, you know, Ronda should be treated like Brock in that she should not be full-time on the roster. And you know, with Brock, even after all these years, and largely I think because he doesn't show up all the time, he still has that aura about him that just makes him different from everybody else. Even if you don't like Brock Lesnar, I think if you're one of these people that is so sick to death of this guy, all he does is suplex, he wrestles for 90 seconds and his face turns purple, he's boring, he never shows up, he never speaks. If you don't like Brock, that's fine, I can totally understand that, but you would be lying if you didn't admit that when the guy shows up, business picks up. It's a different vibe. It's a different feeling when this guy shows up and walks into a building. You don't have to like the guy to admit that. If you say otherwise, you're wrong. You're just flat out wrong. And even after 5 years, 5.5 years, this guy has been back, because he doesn't show up all the time, he still has that. And also because he rarely loses, I'm sure that doesn't hurt. But he still has that aura. He feels real. And all these other people are just sort of, you know, playing make-believe. They need to do something similar with Ronda, just in terms of making her feel like a big deal. Now, I do like the idea of portraying the MMA girls as the heels, with the WWE women sort of, you know, defending the honor of the wrestlers. That could be the basis for this entire thing, us against them. And I know it's a bit of a stretch because Shayna Baszler is actually about to debut in NXT. So now, you know, she is a wrestler. She's actually been wrestling on indies for a few years. But, you know, whatever. You take a little bit of creative license with the story. But the whole us against them thing, you know, look, it worked for Big Show and Mayweather. It's hard to believe that when that thing started, they actually thought, WWE thought that people would cheer Floyd Mayweather over their guy when that angle first started. But whatever they do, they got to do it big. Make the most of the media exposure. Get that first big confrontation all over SportsCenter, which they will anyway because they have a business relationship with ESPN. So, look, if they wanted Hideo Itami's debut to be on SportsCenter, I'm sure they could probably convince them to report on Hideo Itami's debut like it's a big deal. Surely with Ronda, they can get, you know, maximum publicity out of this. And all I can say is, you know, it's times like this where I wish the women had someone like a 98 Steve Austin to do the talking during something like this. If they had a woman who was, verbally, who is as gifted as Austin was back then in these types of situations, that's the person who I would want doing the talking. I don't really think they have somebody like that. In fact, I know they don't. You know, Charlotte has her moments, but Charlotte ain't no 98 Steve Austin. They just don't have that person, but you work with what you got. Former WWE and TNA referee Earl Hebner gave an interview to Sports Illustrated telling them that he is a free agent and he is open to offers. That's offers to referee, not other offers. Although he is unemployed, so you never know what people are willing to do to make some money. Guy is 68 years old, and he still wants to referee. And, you know, given all the bumps out of the ring that he's taken over the years, at that age, I think it's pretty damn impressive that he's still able to referee. I don't think referees get enough credit for all the wear and tear on their shoulder, on their arm, just, you know, the repetitive motion. There's a lot of referees who don't even last nearly that long. Poor Tim White, you know, he got hurt that one time in that Hell in a Cell match, put his shoulder out, tried to come back and couldn't, and his career ended early. And he was a longtime referee for the company as well. So I think to be almost 70, and by all accounts, to still be in pretty good physical shape and still wanting to get out there and referee is very impressive. And, you know, being a referee also, it's an important job. It is an important job. It's not just a position where you're just a sort of a background player. At least in WWE, it's one of the most important jobs that you can have. So anyway, I just thought I would mention that. I don't think they get enough credit. But he said he signed a 2-year extension in March with Impact Wrestling. He thought that Anthem had their act together when they bought the company, but he said it's been one pay cut after another, so he decided to ask for his release. He said some of the wrestlers were getting paid $100 a day, which in his view was a slap in the face to the wrestlers. He was upset that Impact did not fly their regular referees up to Ottawa for Bound for Glory, and instead they decided to use local referees, which I talked about that at the time, that Impact had made the decision, you know, as a cost-cutting move, we're not going to pay our regular referees anymore. Now, Earl here is saying that it was his choice. He asked for his release. That's his you know, position on this. I don't really recall if the story was that the referees were offered pay cuts and they decided to leave on their own, or if they were basically released and it was not of their own decision. Earl is saying otherwise, so that's his story. But they did that because local referees are cheaper, and Earl said as much here in this interview. He says he was very upset by that because they wanted to go the cheap way, and so they went with local referees, and in his words, he said, you get what you pay for, which, ouch, if you're those referees that they use up for Bound for Glory, that's kind of a slap in the face. So he's not very happy with how his run ended there. He spent 12 years there. He was in Impact for 12 years after 17 years working for WWE. One of the first big angles I can remember watching as a kid was that twin referee angle they did in 88 when Hogan lost the title to Andre on NBC. Now think about this, 33 million people watched at least part of the show that night. And I think there were only two matches on the show. It was one of these live, like, Friday night NBC specials. They had an Intercontinental title match, and then I think they had the WWF title match. 33 million people watched at least part of that. Now, I'm sure that's a worldwide number, not just the U.S. number, but that's a lot of people. And his older brother, Dave, had already been a referee there for a while. They poached Earl away from the NWA. He had been reffing there. And as part of this angle, they had him come out for the Hogan-Andre match, and he basically took his brother's place, unbeknownst to everybody. He was the referee for the main event that night. Hogan, if you remember, Andre, I think they called it like a hip toss. I don't know what it was. Andre sort of just fell on Hogan. Andre was just god-awful at this point. He could barely move. It was painful to watch this guy. He was just absolutely terrible. So he sort of fell on Hogan. And Earl counts one. Hogan gets a shoulder up, clear as day. Earl just keeps his head down and counts the two and counts the three. And it was a shocking thing at the time. Hogan had been champion for about 4 years, I think, 4.5 straight years, uninterrupted. And he gets screwed out of the championship here in this way. Hebner counts the fall. Only after the match did we learn that he had been paid off by the Million Dollar Man. Dave came out. I guess he was locked in a broom closet backstage or something. And so you see Hogan, just the visual of Hogan, who is beside himself. He's in the ring looking at these two identical twins. He's looking at two Hebners. He's looking at what he thinks are two Dave Hebners looking at each other. He can't believe it. Earl then, he thinks it's like some kind of optical illusion. Earl attacks his brother. He kicks him so hard he legit broke his ribs. Hogan then picks up Earl, who, you know, if he weighed, you know, $150, that was a lot. He picks Earl up over his head and absolutely just launches him into the aisleway where Andre and DiBiase and I think Virgil, all three of them were in the aisleway. So they're standing there. Now, today, it's commonplace. We see it every week on WWE television. Everybody gets together outside the ring and somebody jumps out and everybody catches them. So that's kind of what they were supposed to do. It didn't quite work out that way because Hogan launched him so hard, he overshot Andre and DiBiase and Virgil. It was actually a horrific bump. I can't believe he wasn't, you know, seriously hurt. Even by today's standards, you go back and watch that bump, it looked way too dangerous. So then after the match, Hogan cries like a bitch to Mean Gene about how they looked identical and how, you know, how much did the plastic surgery cost. This is one of the all-time great promos, by the way. And they show a replay, and on the replay, Hogan, he's crying here. And Hogan's like, you can see the $100 bills falling out of the referee's pocket. He literally cried through the entire promo. You know, John Cena comes out after losing the championship smiling like nothing even happened. Back then, people cared. I'll say that much for Hogan. Back then, people cared. At least they pretended like they cared. Now they don't give a shit. Obviously, people remember Earl for his role in the Montreal Screwjob. He will be forever linked to it no matter what he does. And he doesn't seem to mind. Look, he's made a lot of money off the Screwjob. He even had those Damn Right I Did t-shirts made. He used to sell them at the TNA shows for $10 a pop. He was a big part of that company's history. Now he wants to come back. He said that he would love to go back to WWE and finish his career there. Vince McMahon has always been good to me, he said. And that's the line that I have a problem with. First of all, you could argue that he put Earl in an impossible position in Montreal back in 97. Earl was fearful for his job. To me, that sounds like a pretty shitty thing for your boss to do. Hey, go fuck this guy over. You see this guy over here, your friend? Go fuck him over, or you're out of a job. I don't know if Vince ever said it in those in such explicit words, but that's certainly how Earl has portrayed that story over the years, and he was put in that position by Vince McMahon. So in fact, no, Vince McMahon has not always treated Earl Hebner, you know, well. But that's not even the issue I have. The issue I have with him saying that, and here's why. The story of why he was fired from WWE in 2005 was that the company found out that he and his brother were selling counterfeit WWE merchandise out of a pro wrestling t-shirt shop, okay, that they had an ownership stake in. And it may have only been Earl. Maybe Dave didn't have an ownership stake, but Earl did at the time. I don't remember. Quick little side story on that store. If it's the same store I'm thinking of, which I believe it is, I was there. One of my clients at the time was having a pair of grand openings for some new stores in St. Louis. One of them was at the West County Mall, and the other was at the South County Mall. This had to have been the like end of 07. This was right around the time I started doing this podcast, probably within weeks after I started doing this show. So I fly in the night before the opening. I'm at the mall. I'm just, you know, making sure everything looks good for the next day and all the stuff is there. The big giant scissors and the balloons and the ribbons and everything because we're going to have this big, you know, grand opening the next day. So everything looks great. And as I'm going to leave, as I'm walking through the mall to leave the mall, I come across the Pro Wrestling T-shirt Shop. And it's got a wrestling theme marquee outside the store. It's got this big illustration of what clearly is supposed to be Stone Cold Steve Austin. It's like a silhouette of clearly it's supposed to be Stone Cold. And they had shirts in the store. They had old VHS tapes in the store, magazines and event programs, like all kind of stuff. It wasn't just shirts. And the guy who works there, I guess he was the store manager, he says, hey, you want to see the Hall of Fame? And he brings me to the back of the store. And in the back on the wall is the St. Louis Wrestling Hall of Fame. Which, by the way, that one wall is more of an actual Hall of Fame than the WWE Hall of Fame. At least in this case, there is a physical Hall of Fame. So they have this on the wall, and they had the old, like an old ring bell. I think it might have been mounted to the wall. But it was the old ring bell that they used to use at the Kiel Auditorium for the old Wrestling at the Chase shows in St. Louis, which used to be very popular. And I'm like, what the hell have I stumbled into here? Like this, as a wrestling fan, I'm like, this is awesome. This is great. I wish we had something like this back in New York. I leave the store, And before I go to leave the mall, I turn around. I want to take a picture of the marquee. I got to take a picture of this. And this was before I even had, Jesus Christ, this was probably before I even had a BlackBerry, let alone an iPhone. Although the iPhone came out in 07, I didn't get one for a long time. So I had my old Sony Ericsson clamshell, you know, flip phone. I whip out my flip phone, and I go to take a picture of the marquee. All of a sudden, this mall cop comes over to me. He's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm taking a picture of the store. He's like, why? I mean, maybe he thought I was like casing the place or something. I don't know. Because you guys who have met me know, clearly I look like a very dangerous individual. You see me, you avoid me at all costs. Clearly. He's like, oh, you're not allowed to take pictures in the mall. And he wanted my phone. I don't know if he probably just wanted to delete the photo or something. I'm like, I'm not giving you my phone. In my head, I'm thinking like, what are you, out of your mind? Are you fucking stupid? I'm not giving you my phone. I'm like, I'm just taking a picture in front of the store. You know what I mean? Like, that's all I'm here to do. So I go to leave. I'm like, you know what? Nothing good could come from this. I don't know what this guy's motives are here. I'm going to leave. So I go to leave and he's like walking behind me. It's not like he was like, hey, you stop. But he's like following me. And now I'm freaking out because it's late. The mall's about to close. There's hardly anybody else around. And all I'm thinking is, you know, I've got fucking Paul Blart following me. And I have a grand opening in this mall tomorrow. I'm supposed to be working. I'm here for a client. Now watch this guy go ban me from the mall. You know, like, can you imagine? I fly all the way to St. Louis on business and I can't even enter the mall the next day because I'm banned for taking a picture of a wrestling store on my phone. Oh, that would have been a fun conversation for me to have with my boss when he's like, well, why weren't you there? And I'm like, well, you know, it's kind of a complicated story here. Thankfully, I got the hell out of there. I didn't see this guy when I came back the next day. That would have been very awkward. That was my experience with the old store. I don't think the store is there anymore, or at least it moved, I think, to a different mall, I remember reading. But if it has moved to a different location, I encourage you to go, because I would imagine they still have that St. Louis Wrestling Hall of Fame housed there. It's a pretty cool thing. Anyway, so Earl has given his version of events in older interviews of what happened in terms of his release from WWE. He claims that John Laurinaitis, for whatever reason, had it out for his brother. He didn't like him. He wanted him gone from the company. So they pinned the story of the stolen merch on him, on Earl. And he claims, I didn't do anything wrong. Wasn't me. He was the scapegoat. And I remember the story very well. Earl was actually fired before Dave was. They fired Dave only after they apparently uncovered more evidence of what the two of them had been doing. Now, if in fact they were selling bootleg merchandise, then the company was well within its rights to get rid of them. How do you not? And I don't doubt that part of it also may well have been, this might have been a Jim Johnston type of situation, where you have somebody who's been working for the company for so long and they're making so much money that they just didn't want to pay them that much money anymore. I mean, Earl, after the Montreal stuff, there were rumors that he got a contract that was worth up to $500,000 a year. Now, I don't know if that was just a rumor, if the number was inflated, but my understanding is whatever it was, whether it was $500,000 or, you know, a little bit less than that, is that for his role in what happened in Montreal, he was rewarded. He was compensated. He was taken care of. Okay? He was making a lot of money as a referee. Then they find out about this. So I'm not surprised that they cut the cord so quick. But that line about how Vince treated me so good, he's always been good to me. He did an interview a few years ago, Earl did, where he said that there's so much BS up in WWE, like political BS up in WWE. It's unbelievable, he said. I had to look up the quote. It's unbelievable. And I don't need to go back there. All of a sudden, he's out of a job. He's singing a different tune. I mean, I guess they all do. He is far from the only one. Everybody says they'll never go back, right? Until they do. And Earl Hebner is one in a long line of many people who have done this before. And I have nothing against Earl. I've met Earl a few times. There's a photo of him and I in the ring together from that first fan fest that WWE did in 94. It's on my Facebook page. He was nice as can be. Same when I met him. I talked to him also at the TNA show they did at Webster Hall back in 2008. I like Earl. The guy is a legend. I think he belongs in the WWE Hall of Fame. if they ever decide to induct referees, which I don't believe they have yet. Tommy Young is another one who belongs in there from the NWA, but they really have not shown an interest in inducting referees or behind-the-scenes people. I mentioned Jim Johnston last week, and it sucks. It really sucks because those people deserve recognition too. I mean, I get that somebody like Earl Hebner, he's not going to sell a single ticket to the Hall of Fame ceremony. Believe me, there is not a single person, unless you are part of the Hebner family, who is going to buy a ticket to the Hall of Fame when otherwise they were not going to. I get that. I get that it's not a sexy induction for ESPN or for People Magazine, but I think it's shameful. Maybe I'm just, you know, putting more stock into this Hall of Fame than I should, but I think it's shameful that someone like Drew Carey gets an induction speech and some of these other people don't. They've been working there 20, 25, 30 years. But he's the highest profile referee that they've ever had. The article indicated that he reffed 12 different WrestleMania main events, which has to be a record. For those counting, that's 12 more WrestleMania main events than CM Punk ever appeared in. If it were up to me, I'd put him in the Hall of Fame and I would let him officiate one match at WrestleMania for old time's sake. I think that the Triple H Kurt Angle match, which has been rumored, if that happens, if that is the match at WrestleMania next year, I think that would be the perfect match for Earl Hebner to come in and referee. Two guys that he's worked with before. He has a history. We know he has a history storyline-wise with Triple H. And they've done similar stuff with Jim Ross on commentary before. They bring him in to call a special match here and there at WrestleMania. There's no reason that they can't do the same thing with Earl Hebner. But as a full-time referee, I would not bring him back. They don't need him. They have their own referees. They're much younger. They still have Mike Chioda, who's not young. But, you know, he's their senior referee. He's been doing this a long time. He's probably the leader of the whole crew. They've got a whole army of referees. They don't need to bring back a 68-year-old man for a full-time referee gig. I think a one-off at WrestleMania is the way to go. Let's talk about Raw. Finally, probably should get to that. Raw was live from Los Angeles on Monday. Over 2,000 of you voted, 64% thumbs up, 36% thumbs down. So big thumbs up you guys gave Raw on Monday. A very wrestling-heavy show. Four different matches on this show that went 15 minutes or above. Which, you know, if you look at the ratings, was ratings poison because I think the drop-off from hour one to hour three was the biggest drop-off ever, or one of the top two maybe biggest drop-offs in the history of the show in terms of viewers. They lost something like 600,000 or 700,000 people tuned out of the show as it went on. I'm sure long wrestling matches with people they didn't care about probably had a lot to do with that. But we had Roman Reigns beating Jason Jordan in the opener to retain the Intercontinental title. The slow burn heel turn for Jordan continues. A lot of the little things they're doing with him. They're doing exactly what they should be doing with him so far. They're clearly building to a father-son match at some point. Samoa Joe attacked Roman Reigns after the match until Jordan made the save, and then Roman gave Jordan a Superman punch to show his appreciation. What a dick. What a dick, this Roman Reigns. Speaking of Roman Reigns, Roman Reigns this week on that new Straight to the Source show with Corey Graves on the WWE Network called himself the best performer in-ring in the world today. He's not even the best in-ring performer in the company he works for. The fact that he made it a point to say in-ring, that's what got a lot of people riled up and why I made fun of it. You know, on Twitter, I said, if WWE is going to allow Roman Reigns to wrestle with that type of head trauma, then surely they can allow Daniel Bryan to wrestle another match. But, hey, it's always good to be confident in one's abilities. Nothing wrong with that. If he thinks he's the best, that's great. I do agree with the rest of his quote, the rest of what he said, which is that if you go back and you look at his pay-per-view matches over the last 3 years, he's had a lot of great matches. I'm not saying he hasn't. Look, I've given him praise. I've defended him for it here on this show, oftentimes to my own detriment. I've eaten shit from people. I mean, anytime I say anything nice about Roman Reigns, there's a certain segment of the wrestling population that I get shit from. But, yeah, I've talked about his matches before, and mainly his pay-per-view matches, and he's had a lot of really good ones. You know, the WrestleMania match with Brock Lesnar, the matches he had last year with AJ at those two shows, the series that he had this year with Braun Strowman, which really helped Strowman. And I think Roman deserves a lot of credit for, you know, aiding in the ascension of Braun Strowman. I mean, the company gave him the ball to run with, you know, that was a Vince call, and they deserve credit for that, and it's worked out well so far. But Roman Reigns deserves a lot of credit also for, you know, working with the guy and putting him over and making him look like a monster, because they created a main event star out of somebody who, I think when he got called up to the main roster a couple of years ago, he completely bypassed NXT. If he had even 10 matches, you know, to his entire career before he debuted on Raw, that would probably be a few more than he actually had. That's how little experience this guy had when he first got called up as part of the Wyatt family, and 2 years later, he was in the main event of SummerSlam wrestling for the championship. So they created a main, not just a star, but a main event star out of nothing. Roman played a, you know, a very big role in that. You know, I didn't like either of the singles matches that Roman had at WrestleMania. I thought they were unbelievably boring. But, you know, that outside of the Roman match, I'm talking the match with Triple H and the match this year with The Undertaker. Did not like either one of those matches, but to be fair to him, I mean, I think that probably had, you know, that probably had more to do with who he was in the ring with. You know, Triple H and Undertaker, they're not exactly what they used to be. Can't put that all on Roman. Even the match he had with Jason Jordan on this show, I thought was really good. But I can't take this guy seriously making a comment like that when you have AJ Styles working for the same company. I'm sorry, I just can't take that comment seriously. Clash of Champions next Sunday, I think, is going to be a real test for AJ, because he's a guy who, you know, you say, oh, he can make anybody look good, and I think he can. Well, he's going to be in there with a guy who stunk up more than one pay-per-view main event this year. You know, they had that match on TV last month. It was fine. On pay-per-view, I want to see what kind of match AJ can have with Jinder Mahal. I am morbidly curious to see what kind of match these two can pull off. I mentioned 205 Live in the stuff with Rich Swann earlier, which brings me to Drew Gulak. Drew Gulak pinned Mustafa Ali to win the second fatal four-way match with the Cruiserweights in as many weeks here on this show. This match also had Tony Nese and Cedric Alexander in it. It meant that Gulak was going to move on to Raw tomorrow night to meet Rich Swann, and from there we would find out who the number one contender was for the Cruiserweight title. That ain't going to happen now, we know that. And I suspect that we will end up with some kind of again, I said earlier, I would do a multi-man match to open the show, and the winner faces, Gulak later on. And why not plug Hideo Itami into that hole and just, you know, start him out hot. But in this match, I thought this was probably the best Cruiserweight match on Raw all year. You know, the ones I've paid attention to, because some of them I admit I haven't, but I thought this was great. There was a point in the match where Mustafa Ali did a picture-perfect top rope Spanish fly to Cedric Alexander. A lot of cool moves in this match, as there should be. You know, I don't want to see the Cruiserweights in there doing headlocks and chin locks. I'm sorry, that's boring. That's not why I want to watch Cruiserweight matches. Gulak stole the pin on Ali after he had been laid out with the lumbar check. So Gulak stole the pin. Imagine the kind of match they had here on this show, opening Raw every week right after they started the division last year. Had they gotten them off to a hot start like that and followed the Nitro formula and opened the show with a hot Cruiserweight match to, you know, just give the show some energy instead of opening the show with more talking, would that not have been the better way to go? Right? Would that not have been one way to get people excited right out of the gate about this division? They botched it from the very first night. Remember Mick Foley coming out with cue cards? Oh my God. From night one, they fucked this whole thing up. But imagine if they would have started out hot that way. Well, they didn't give us that, but they are doing 205 Live house shows for the first time next month. There's three of them on the schedule, January 19, 20, and 21, all in smaller venues on the East Coast. They're running Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York. Not New York City, they're running Poughkeepsie, New York, at the Mid-Hudson Civic Center. WWE used to run shows there all the time back in the day. I used to see on my local feed when I would watch Superstars and Wrestling Challenge, I would hear Howard Finkel do the cut-ins, or Sean Mooney would have like an event center update, and they would be plugging events at the Mid-Hudson Civic Center in Poughkeepsie, New York. I never went to Poughkeepsie. Poughkeepsie's about 2 hours away from where I am. I've never gone there before, but they hosted some Raws, I think, from there in the mid-90s as well. It's a small building, which they're going to have to be. They're going to have to be small. I just find it hilarious that they announce this a week after putting out a survey asking fans, why are you not watching 205 Live? So now they're going to do house shows. And these house shows are headlined by Kalisto challenging Enzo Amore for the Cruiserweight title with Nia Jax as the guest referee. Because now Nia and Enzo, I guess, are going to be an item. This is like the New Age version of China and Eddie Guerrero, only not as good. They did a backstage deal on this show where Nia walked up to him and smiled and said, how you doing? If I'm Kalisto, I'm protesting this. How can she be unbiased as a referee, right? If I'm Kalisto, that's what you do. But seriously, I mean, unless it was 5 minutes from your house, ask yourself this question. Unless it was 5 minutes from your house, would you drive all the way to that show and buy a ticket to see Enzo Amore and Kalisto in the main event? I'm very curious, because I know some people like 205 Live and watch it religiously every single week. Would you buy a ticket and travel to a 205 Live show knowing that all you're going to get are the 205 Live guys? You're not going to get any big names. You know, you're not going to get any sort of... Now, maybe, look, I think the smart thing for them to do, at least initially, would be to maybe not load up the show, but, you know, include on the show some special attractions from, let's say, NXT. Use some of the UK guys, you know, Pete Dunne and Tyler Bate and all those. They've got to have more than just Enzo and Gulak and Kalisto and Nice. I mean, to run a show with those guys and nothing else, to me, it just sounds like death. How many people are they going to get into the building for a show like that? Now, if they can keep their costs down and they can run small buildings and actually turn a profit on it, then fine, it makes sense. But this sounds like a train wreck waiting to happen. It's like taking a minor character on a television show that used to be really popular and giving that character their own spinoff. You know, so it's an experiment, but I don't think it's going to last very long. They tried this with their ECW brand, which actually, you could argue ECW was a bigger deal than 205 Live was. But they tried this with their ECW brand many years ago. It failed. I suspect this will end up the same way. We also had the best Bray Wyatt segment all year, and we can thank Matt Hardy for it. Matt Hardy is officially woken. He looks like Broken Matt. He's got the accent like Broken Matt, all the mannerisms and the vocabulary of Broken Matt. But instead of broken, he is now woken. They did a dueling pre-tape promo on the big screen where they cut back and forth between the two of them. This was a lot of fun. Crowd popped huge for Matt when he first showed up on the screen. Bray called Matt a fool. He said that he created this illusion to mask his own failures. What is he, jealous? If anybody should know about failures, it's Bray Wyatt. Maybe after all this, we get Broken Bray, so he can hide his own failures. Matt talked about battling Genghis Khan and dancing with Cleopatra. He called Bray the consumer of terrestrial entities, which sounds a lot cooler, I will say, than the eater of worlds. He sentenced Bray to deletion, and then the two of them had a laughing contest, which honestly was the best part, I think, of the entire show. It was like watching two mental patients off their meds. For the first time in forever, I'm actually looking forward to a Bray Wyatt segment tomorrow night. I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know how many times they could have dueling big screen promos. At some point, they've got to do more than that. But I am excited to see what they have in store here for these guys. I never thought I would hear myself say those words, but there it is. One thing I hope they do is more pre-tape stuff with Matt outside the ring. I went back and I watched Final Deletion earlier this week because I was what happened was I was watching this segment again on the WWE YouTube channel. And I can count on one hand how many times I've watched a segment from Raw and then I've gone back on their YouTube channel and watched it again, and I'd probably still have fingers left over. Okay, that's how little that happens anymore. But I went on their YouTube channel, I watched the segment again, and you know how they have the recommended videos on the sidebar? They showed Final Deletion, which is still up on the Impact Wrestling YouTube channel. So I watched it. It, you know, it'd been many months since I had seen this thing. I mean, it goes back to last year, I think. So I watched it, and it just reminded me of this, the brilliance of the whole thing. And it's one of those things, you either love it or you hate it. I fell into the camp that loved it. If you hated it, if you thought it was too hokey, if you thought it completely exposed pro wrestling. First of all, it's 2017, almost 2018. Pro wrestling's been exposed for a long time. Get over it. But, you know, if it's not your thing, then fine, I get it. But I love the hell out of it. I thought it was very creative. Watching him with, you know, King Maxwell at the birthday party, and the Senor Benjamin gives him the xylophone, and then they're preparing the field for massacre. And the way they shot that whole thing, Jeff's in the house strumming a guitar, all of a sudden he gets attacked by this army of drones, and it was corny as all hell, but I thought, you know, for the resources they had to put that whole thing together, them and Borash and whoever else was involved, I think Billy Corgan, I don't know how involved he was, but I know he sort of had a hand in overseeing it. Kudos to those guys, because even going back and watching it, you know, on what may have been a shoestring budget, it was a hell of an effort. It really was. And I want to see Matt in situations like that. I want to see Matt, if the story is that this guy was losing and his brother got hurt and he's all by himself and he's losing and he just snaps. He loses his mind. He has gone insane. If that is the story, I would love to see Matt with the hair in the getup, right, wearing the broken Matt outfit, out on the street going shopping in a store. Maybe he's in Toys R Us going shopping for a gift for King Maxwell or Baby Wolfgang. I think that's his other son's name, right, Wolfgang? not the UK star. Matt Hardy is, in fact, not Wolfgang's father from ICW. But just, I don't know, something like that, man on the street type stuff, him in these like real life situations, but like dressed up as Broken Matt, doing the Broken Matt, accent and everything. I just think there's comedy gold. Like, I don't want to just see this guy on the screen and in the ring. I want to see him out and about doing stuff, you know, because when I would see Broken Matt when he was first doing this and they showed things like Final Deletion and stuff, and then you would see him in the Impact Zone, I'll be honest with you, I liked it less. I didn't like it as much than when he was doing other stuff, like extracurricular stuff. So I want to see him in the outside world doing more stuff. It's only week one, but going forward, I hope we get to see more of that. The good news is that according to Sports Illustrated, and they've been hit or miss, Sports Illustrated has with their news, so take it with a grain of salt, but according to them, they claim a WWE source actually reached out to them to tell them that Vince McMahon apparently is a big fan of the Woken stuff because he sees a lot of money in it. And that's the key. That's the key to getting to Vince McMahon. If you can speak his language, which is dollar signs, that's how you get through to this guy. That's how you win him over. So if he believes in this, and if he believes that this is just a gold mine in terms of merch and they can make a lot of money off it, then that's great news. And apparently he has given Matt creative license, or at least up to a point, he's given him a lot of creative leeway to do what he wants with the character, to make recommendations and tweaks and all that kind of stuff. If that's true, this thing is going to be huge because it's Matt's baby. He is not going to screw this up. WWE could screw this up, but if they're giving him the power or enough, you know, leeway to kind of do his own thing and make suggestions that they actually go with, then I have no doubt in my mind this thing is going to blow up and be even bigger than it was last year. I'm very optimistic about this in light of this news. Think about what this guy was able to do with a limited budget in TNA. Probably it was all his own money. You know, with a couple of drones and Roman candles. Look at what he was able to do. Now imagine if WWE gets behind it. Imagine what he could do with this now. Before I move on here, as I suspected, WWE has now put a statement out. They have given a statement to PW Insider about the arrest of Rich Swann. This is what the company says. WWE has zero tolerance for matters involving domestic violence, and as per our policy, Rich Swann has been indefinitely suspended following his arrest. So there you go. As I suspected, as I suggested earlier, they probably would suspend him without pay. I assume this is without pay. That I don't know, but they have suspended him pending the outcome of these charges. And we'll see what happens as far as that goes from here. Rollins and Ambrose on this show were in the main event, challenging Sheamus and Cesaro for the Raw Tag Team titles. Really good main event up until the shitty DQ for kicking too much ass finish, which I hate. But it turned out to be a false finish. Kurt Angle came out. He refused to let the match end like that. He restarted it as a no disqualification match. Samoa Joe ran out through the crowd about a minute later. He laid out Rollins and Ambrose. Roman Reigns came down to make the save. And in the middle of all of this confusion, Sheamus hit the brogue kick on Dean Ambrose, and Cesaro got the pin to retain the tag team titles. That sets up a six-man tag that they've already taped for the Tribute to the Troops show, which I believe airs this Thursday. This is WWE week on USA Network, hence why NXT is airing on USA this one time on Wednesday. So they've already announced five matches for Raw tomorrow night, which I think may be a new record. One of them will be changed now that we know Rich Swann is suspended. It was going to be Rich Swann and Mr. PowerPoint, Drew Gulak, and now they'll have to come up with a different idea. We have Kane against Braun Strowman. We have Seth Rollins against Sheamus. We have, for the first time ever, Dean Ambrose against Samoa Joe. And Roman Reigns against Cesaro, which I assume is for the Intercontinental title. Don't know that for a fact, but it would make sense. So they had announced five, now we're down to four, but obviously they'll be doing something with the Cruiserweights to determine a new number one contender. We'll find out tomorrow night what that is. SmackDown on Tuesday was from San Diego, and it is Rusev Day next Sunday. Well, it's Rusev Day every day. Today is Rusev Day, but next Sunday will also be Rusev Day. Rusev and Aiden English beat Kofi Kingston and Big E on this show to earn a spot in the tag team title match at Clash of Champions, making that match, what else, a fatal four-way. They should rename this company FFW. At least this time, I think it's going to be a great match. I will not complain about this being a fatal four-way. I will continue to mock them because I think it's to the point of parody at this point, all of the fatal four-ways and fatal five-ways. I will always make fun of that because there's just too many of them, but this is one I can get behind. It's going to be Rusev and Aiden English, Gable and Benjamin, New Day, and the Usos for the SmackDown Tag Team titles next Sunday. And you know, Rusev and Aiden English have become a fantastic act. I'm really happy for Aiden English. I mean, I wrote him off. I mean, he was a guy without a role on this show after Simon Gotch got let go. He was a prelim act. That's really all he was. I didn't even think he would get TV time. Rusev was also, he was another guy with no direction. Now, he was higher up on the totem pole than Aiden English was, but for all intents and purposes, they were one and the same. They were two guys that had no role on this show. They were not being pushed. They were not a significant part of the show. They put the two of them together by happenstance, and we got gold out of it. Best thing going on SmackDown right now is the Rusev-Aiden English act. Speaking of the New Day, get a load of this. All you Star Trek fans out there are going to love this. I know, she's Star Wars, don't get on my case. I don't really give a shit about either one, but she was in the Star Wars movies. Carrie Fisher. Carrie Fisher, as you all know, passed away last year. A year ago, in fact. And this is, by the way, a real story. When I first heard this, I thought this was a kayfabe news story. But this is, in fact, a real story. There was an auction recently that included items that were found in Carrie Fisher's kitchen at the time of her death. It was the personal property auction of Carrie Fisher and her mom, Debbie Reynolds, who died the very next day, actually. Carrie Fisher died, and then the next day, her mother died. If you skip to page 245 in the auction guide, which is accessible online, there is a photo of the items in Carrie Fisher's kitchen. From her Beverly Hills home. She probably had multiple homes. There's a few spray bottles. There's a couple of old cleanser boxes, whatever the hell those are. And then off to the left is a box of Bootio's cereal. They don't mention that in the description in the auction guide beneath the photo, because God only knows what the writer must have thought when he or she saw this thing. So in the description, they're listing all the items, and they actually wrote, and more, at the end. I guess the Bootio's box and more that they described. Anyway, the whole set apparently sold for somewhere between $300 and $500, making the most expensive box of Bootio's ever sold. What a random thing. Like, I would like to think other celebrities have these obscure WWE items in their homes that we don't know about. Like, I'll bet anything that Mia Khalifa has one of those New Day unicorn headbands in her apartment, and she doesn't wear it on her head either. I slept through everything else on this show, aside from the main event. Not gonna lie. That's how boring this show was outside of Rusev. I saw there was a Charlotte versus Tamina match, so I see that I did not miss much. Main event was Randy Orton and Sami Zayn. Kevin Owens was handcuffed to the bottom rope during the match. Zayn, later on in the match, pulled out a pair of bolt cutters from underneath the ring. He tried to free Owens, but Orton cut him off. Owens ended up cutting the cuffs off on his own. He distracted Randy Orton, which led to a near fall from Sami Zayn. Zayn went for the Huluva kick. He missed, and Orton rolled him up for the pin. Now, earlier in the show, Shane McMahon had announced that it would be Owens and Zayn against Randy Orton and a partner of his choosing at Clash of Champions, basically in the match where we don't have anything for these guys to do, so let's just put them all in a tag team match. The partner will be Shinsuke Nakamura, who ran out to make the save and is also my early favorite to win next year's Royal Rumble match, assuming that AJ does not lose the title back to Jinder Mahal next Sunday, God forbid. So Nakamura hit Kinshasa's on both Owens and Zayn. Randy Orton did the same with the RKO, laid them both out. The big stip for that match next Sunday, that tag team match, is that if Owens and Zayn lose the match, not only are they fired from SmackDown, they are gone from WWE. That includes Raw. They cannot go to Monday Night Raw. They are gone from the company. Now, I'm not sure why Shane would have sway over Triple H and Stephanie, since they both hate his guts. They've been feuding. But apparently he also has hiring power. He has power over the hiring decisions on Monday Night Raw. I'd love to hear the explanation for that one. And that's how SmackDown went off the air. So they're building around Owens and Zayn, but you know, I can't say I'm overly excited by what they've been doing. Really, this just sounds like a way to build up whatever they're doing with Shane McMahon and Daniel Bryan. And I keep going back to this idea that, boy, they're investing an awful lot of time, and they're dropping a lot of little hints and a lot of little teases at tension between the two of them, and I don't know where it's going, but it sure looks like it's leading to a match at some point. And I'm not saying that the plan is for Daniel Bryan to wrestle a match at WrestleMania, that it's already a done deal. I don't think it is. I genuinely don't think that anything has changed as far as them making a decision to clear him. He and his wife keep saying there's a chance that they're still going to doctors. It's up to Dr. Maroon. It's going to be his call. It's still being considered. But I believe that no decision has been made, but they're building this up. It almost seems like as though they think there's a chance that, yeah, you know what? It may lead to a match at some point. So I'm genuinely interested, I guess, to see where it goes. But right now, as of this moment, they're building, the biggest storyline is being built up between two non-wrestlers. I know Shane wrestles, but really two non-wrestlers. Shane and Daniel Bryan. So maybe that has a lot to do with why I'm just not really interested in what they're doing on SmackDown. I take what I can get with Rusev, and I'm very entertained by his act, and they'll have some good matches on the show sometimes. I am digging what they're doing in the tag team division. I think that match is going to be great next Sunday. But I can't say SmackDown is an overly exciting show right now. And maybe part of that is just the fact that it's December. This is always a dead period for this company. When you're going into the holidays, we've got another 5 weeks, I think, until the Royal Rumble. We're in this lame duck period right now where they're just sort of filling TV time and there's a whole lot of nothing going on. So I'm sure that's part of it too. Pro Wrestling Sheet broke the news that WWE is in serious discussions internally about doing a global warning pay-per-view from Australia next October. It would air on pay-per-view and on the WWE network. The last time WWE did a global warning show, they did a tour in Australia. It was back in 2002, a few weeks before SummerSlam. That was the show that had the main event for the Undisputed title, Triple Threat, with The Rock, Brock Lesnar, and Triple H. Which, before Brock and Triple H had their feud in 2012, as far as I know, that was the only time those two ever were in the ring together. Maybe there was a house show match that I'm... Actually, I think there might have been a house show match, now that I think about it. But the point is that Triple H and Brock, at least on camera, on television, it just didn't happen. It was this triple threat in Australia, and aside from that, the two of them never really... Yeah, they just never really crossed paths with each other. They did 56,000 people for that show at Colonial Stadium in Melbourne. This time they're looking at an even bigger venue, the Melbourne Cricket Ground, which apparently holds 100,000 people. Cool. That's the sort of thing I'd like to see them doing on the network. I'd like to see them go to different places around the world You know, a big stadium, great. The bigger the better if they think they could fill it and have it as like a one-off network special. I really liked the Beast in the East show they did. I think that was, what, back in 2015? I'd like to see them do more of that. You know, you can go to a small hall in Japan that fits 2,000 people. You can go to Australia and try to get, you know, 65,000 people. That's what I'd like to see them doing more of on the network. And the Aussie fans are nuts. I say that in a good way. It's kind of like the UK fans. They're crazy. I've had UK fans tell me that they're crazy, so I don't think I'm speaking... I don't think I'm saying anything that the UK fans don't already know. And they have all the soccer chants and the sports chants and everything else. So I think if you can pack a lot of Australian fans in one place, I think you'd have a really fun show. I think as much for the crowd reaction than anything else. So I hope they do it.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT, the fatal four-way to determine a challenger for Andrade Cien Almas at TakeOver Philly is taking shape. This week we had Killian Dane against Trent Seven and Cassius Ohno against Johnny Gargano to determine two of the spots in the fatal four-way. It was supposed to be Velveteen Dream against Ohno, but Regal said that Dream was hurt. I think he hurt his back, at least in storyline, at TakeOver War Games in the match with Aleister Black. Speaking of Almas, he was out for his championship victory celebration with Zelina Vega. She told us all to rise for our new NXT champion. And then Almas spoke. Not very well. His English is not great. I'm debating in my head whose English is worse, either him or Nakamura. Actually, I've heard Nakamura's English is actually pretty good, like when you converse with him. But Almas has some work to do on this. He just kept saying, I told you. Over and over again, I told you. He said he hurt McIntyre, then he said sorry, which was kind of funny. I am the champion, he said. Yep, you sure are. And that was that. Nobody came out to argue the point. Lars Sullivan was being hounded at the Performance Center by a bunch of, quote, reporters. He said he will beat Roderick Strong when they have their match, and he will be the one challenging for the NXT title next month. He then screamed, you are fake news, and walked off. No, he didn't. He should have. He should have. Those reporters were literally fake news. Trent Seven and Killian Dane, I was wondering why Trent Seven, and then they answered my question by telling us that he won a battle royal at one of the NXT live events in Florida to earn this spot. It wasn't much of a match. Dane mostly destroyed him, won with the Vader bomb. Sonya Deville against Ruby Riott. In the battle of absolution against the Riot Squad. See, and they said Survivor Series is the one night of year where Raw and SmackDown are in competition with each other. They lied. Bunch of liars. This was no holds barred, no rope breaks in this match. And that helped Ruby beat Sonya in their first meeting. There would be no rope break to save her here in this match. Deville worked over Ruby's leg. Ended up putting her in a triangle, and even though Ruby was in the ropes, it did not matter because, as I mentioned, there were no rope breaks. And she eventually passed out, and Sonya Deville got the win. The match was good. Probably the best Deville, I think, has looked in any match I've ever seen her in. Maybe the longest match she's ever had. And I thought she held up her end pretty well. It, you know, that's what NXT is for. I can only hope that that continues on the main roster. But you would expect that had she stayed longer at NXT, she probably would have gotten a little bit better and a little bit better. I'm not saying that can't happen on the main roster. You know, I mentioned earlier, Braun Strowman completely bypassed NXT. Actually, you know what? I take that back. He was technically in NXT. He was a Rosebud. But Braun Strowman did not debut in NXT. He did not wrestle in NXT. And he turned out pretty good, so... Who's to say that Sonya Deville won't end up being the greatest women's wrestler of our generation? Stranger things have happened. But I always thought that's what NXT was for. Apparently I was wrong. I'll tell you another reason, just really quickly here, why I'm also a little curious in terms of the timing of bringing her up. Because she has the MMA gimmick. She wears the gloves. They talk about her background. That's all well and good. But if they really are going to bring in Ronda Rousey and they're going to do... And like Shayna Baszler is about to make her debut and I don't know. It just seems like the timing maybe wasn't really ideal to bring up somebody doing an MMA fighter gimmick. You know? Unless they just wanted to make room for Shayna Baszler, because they are airing vignettes for the, I guess, what's her name? The Queen of Spades, right? They're airing vignettes teasing the upcoming debut of Shayna Baszler. Maybe they just wanted to move Deville off of NXT to make room for her. That could be why. I may have just answered my own question, but I just thought the timing maybe was a little awkward in terms of calling her up over somebody else. Tyler Bate. Tyler Bate will get his United Kingdom Championship match with Pete Dunne in 2 weeks. This will be their third and final meeting of the year. They first met in the finals of the UK tournament at the beginning of the year. Bate won the championship. Then at TakeOver Chicago, Bate lost the championship to Pete Dunne. So this is the rubber match. Can they top their match from May? Can they top their match from that TakeOver show? That's going to be awfully hard to do, but I will declare right now that if these two guys in 2 weeks can beat that match, if they can have a better match than the one they had at TakeOver, then this will end up being the match of the year for 2017 in WWE. Because right now, that second match they had, in my view, is the match of the year. If they could somehow beat that, then this is a no-brainer as far as match of the year. It's too bad they couldn't time it where the match happens on NXT this week because they're airing on USA Network. Give that match a bigger platform. So you know, NXT airs on USA 7 Eastern this Wednesday, and then it does repeat in its normal slot at 8 p.m. on the network. So, I think everybody listening to this pretty much has USA Network, but if you're a big NXT fan and you're worried that you won't be able to see it for some reason, you can still watch it on the network in its normal slot. Will not be a new episode. It'll just repeat what aired earlier in the night. Ember Moon was being interviewed by the fake news press backstage when Billy Royce and Peyton Kay showed up. They reminded Ember that she did not pin Peyton to win the title at TakeOver. And next week, she's going to challenge Ember for the champion. Actually, Peyton Kay. I meant Billy Kay. Billy Kay and Peyton Royce. I accidentally fused the two of them together. Also next week, Adam Cole challenges Aleister Black in another qualifier for that Fatal 4-Way match. That should be good. That's actually surprising to me that they would put that match together as a qualifier and not put both guys in the Fatal 4-Way. Main event was great. I don't know what else to say about this thing other than you gotta watch it. Cassius Ohno against a mystery opponent, which turned out to be Johnny Gargano. Two men who have not had a lot of luck recently picking up wins. Both looking to turn their fortunes around here. I lost track of how many boots and kicks we saw, mostly from Ohno here in this match. But every time he would hit a big move, Johnny would kick out. The crowd was more into it each time. They were giving them, this is awesome chance, and this is NXT, and all that kind of stuff. And he won with the Gargano escape. And so Johnny Gargano is perhaps turning his luck around. He has now earned himself a spot in that Fatal 4-Way. He could very well go on to challenge Andrade Cien Almas for the championship next month. He's the guy who I pitched for that match, you know, a few weeks ago, so I sure hope it's him. But watch this match. This was the best NXT main event in a while. This was Gargano's first win in a while, the start of the Johnny Gargano Redemption Tour. At least until Tommaso Ciampa shows up and screws it all up. And then they go on to have a match in New Orleans over WrestleMania weekend. At least that's what I would do. TheBlast.com, which is still a pretty new website. It was launched by one of the co-founders of TMZ. So it's almost like a TMZ sister site. They had a story this week about Rob Van Dam, claiming that because of a concussion he suffered in a match last year, which from what I've read anyway, was a match he had with Pentagon Jr. at a PCW wrestling show in November last year. Because of this, he claims, WWE will no longer clear him to wrestle there. And due to the loss of income, he has taken a major financial hit. That comes from documents that he filed as part of his ongoing divorce from his wife, Sonia, as they are now in the process of working out a financial settlement between them. He is arguing that because of this, he should not have to pay what she is asking for because he simply can't afford it. He says the injury from November of last year caused visual impairment and has disqualified him from working for WWE. He also noted that his merchandising contract with WWE expired in July of this year and was not renewed. He included a copy of the medical evaluation from earlier this year confirming the concussion. He claims Sonya is perfectly capable of earning her own income, and he wants the judge to consider his situation before deciding how much money he is going to have to pay her. Who would have thought, right, that a former ECW star who took chair shots to the head and probably took more bumps on top of his head than almost anybody I could think of would end up with concussion issues and with the visual impairment? That sucks to hear, but look, I'm sure he's going to play this up. I'm not saying he didn't suffer a concussion, but he's going to play this up for as much as he can. For all it's worth, he's going to play this up to make sure that he pays as little as possible. This is what happens with divorces. It's really sad, I think, because these two were married for so long. They were married for 17 years. You know, she traveled with him to a lot of his matches. I remember when he announced on his MySpace blog that Sonya was diagnosed with colon cancer, which is terrible. But I think she went into remission the year after. But I remember reading these blogs about their experiences and her talking about her experiences during treatment, and it was pretty harrowing stuff, you know? Nobody should ever have to go through that. You know, I mean, we're going through it right now with my own mother, and I could tell you honestly that there is nothing worse than watching somebody you love suffer and feeling completely helpless to do anything about it. I know that feeling well, unfortunately. So, it's a sad story. They were together, like I said, for a long time. Rob, I know, has been dating Katie Forbes, this woman Katie Forbes, ever since the split. She's also a wrestler. But I guess this closes the door on an RVD return to WWE, because whether he's embellishing for effect or if he's telling the God's honest truth, now that it's out there in the public domain, WWE, if this guy is saying, hey, I've got visual impairment, I got a really bad concussion, they're not going to let him in. They're not going to bring him back, probably even for a one-shot, you know, like in the Royal Rumble or something. So I think for all intents and purposes, his career in WWE is over. That's it. Time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Hassan from London, England. I feel that Braun Strowman has the makings of the next Stone Cold. Do you think he should face Triple H at WrestleMania 35 in something of a Stone Cold versus Mr. McMahon match? Let's say after WrestleMania 34, Triple H becomes the Raw GM after Kurt Angle is fired, and they tease a year-long feud between Strowman and Hunter, which leads to a match, which then leads to Triple H having to retire and Braun being the top star. Hassan, I am also a big Braun Strowman fan, so you and I are on the same page as far as that goes, but I hate the idea of Braun Strowman and Triple H as a WrestleMania match. I said that after Survivor Series when they first teased it. I feel the same way now. If they want to do something at the Royal Rumble to get, you know, give the Rumble another big match, fine, but I don't think it would be a very good match. And to build it up for another year and do it at WrestleMania 35, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And I also don't like the idea of trying to recreate Austin versus McMahon. It can never be as good as the original. You know, and the heel authority figure against the top babyface has been done to death in this company. You know, Don Callis. Don Callis is now with Impact Wrestling. He and Scott D'Amore are going to be running things going forward. The announcement was made this week. He's still going to be the English announcer for New Japan Pro Wrestling, but he is in Impact Wrestling. He is in the executive offices now. He's probably not going to end up being an on-screen character for the promotion, because apparently he feels that the authority figure role on TV is played out. At least as far as being a recurring character on the show every single week, it's been done to death. And you know what? He is absolutely right. WWE could learn a thing or two from that. At least we ended up with a couple of babyface GMs for a change coming out of the brand split, and you have Regal as well in NXT. Regal in NXT is exactly how an authority figure in today's wrestling should be used. On an as-needed basis, contract signings, match announcements, the odd occasion where there's some kind of like a heinous attack and he shows up and snarls at the heels as only he can. Right now, SmackDown is the Shane McMahon show. And don't think for a second that Raw won't be back soon enough to being the Stephanie McMahon show. Okay, we don't need a year of Braun Strowman feuding with the Authority. Been there, done that, don't want to see it. At least with Daniel Bryan, he was the underdog, so the story kind of worked. Strowman's a monster. That's all we hear every week. Kane was on TV on Monday. You're a monster among men, and I'm the monster among monsters, and let's do a monster mash. Like, monster, 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 right? Their favorite drink is Monster. But Strowman is a monster. He's a big dude. He's a big, scary dude. Feuding with feuding with authority figures is not how you book a monster. Just imagine, like, a year of Braun Strowman getting slapped in the face by Stephanie McMahon. It's not my idea of a good time. So, I like Braun. You and I are in agreement on that. Braun and Triple H as a Mania match. Braun and Triple H as a year-long feud? Absolutely not. David from San Diego, what are your thoughts on the Michael Elgin controversy and him selling his Glory Pro promotion? I didn't talk about this earlier because I got a couple of questions, so I figured I would just slot it into the show here. That Elgin situation is a really just fucked up situation. One of his students who performed for what had been his Glory Pro promotion was accused of rape. Or at least attempted rape. I'm a little foggy on which is more accurate here. This happened in March, allegedly. Elgin was aware of the accusations at the time. He knew the woman as well. And then he got rid of the guy, but he only got rid of the guy this month. After she went public with her story. She's also released a series of private DMs between her and Elgin. That's really when Elgin got rid of the guy, and he also very quickly sold his promotion. He also deleted his Twitter, so I guess he didn't have to answer any more questions about this. I saw the texts that she released. Elgin comes across like a real scumbag, calls her crazy. Some of the new DMs that she released on Friday are even worse. Now this is from May, that's how far back these messages go. She asks him if he's going to let that student wrestle on one of his upcoming shows. You're going to let him wrestle on your show? And Elgin basically says, I don't want to hear from you unless you blow me. If she blows him, then we can talk about it. Otherwise, don't bother me. Elgin has a wife and kid, by the way. He's married to another wrestler. So, married or not, you got to be a real lowlife to say something like that to somebody who comes to you and tells you that one of your students tried to rape her. The only thing I can say that I didn't like about all this stuff, like, that she released publicly, it's a touchy thing, when you release private DMs, when is it appropriate to do so? I think in a situation like this, especially if she's telling the truth here, it's absolutely fine. But the one thing I didn't like was she put this series of messages out from a conversation that she and Elgin had where they were talking about Jeff Cobb. And Jeff Cobb, he's been tagging with Cobb in New Japan recently. I don't see any reason to post, though. I mean, he's, like, bashing Cobb in these messages and talking about why he doesn't like him and he's, unreliable and just stuff like that. And I didn't think there was any need to put that out there. I don't really see what that has to do with anything. I almost felt like that was piling on. Not that I have any sympathy for Michael Elgin, really, but that I didn't really like. Just because I didn't think it was relevant to all this other stuff. But the other stuff is fair game, and it is a he said, she said situation. She didn't want to go to the police. That was her decision. And Elgin has his side of the story where he says, well, I told the student to get a lawyer and I told you to go to the cops and I'm caught in the middle and it's not fair to me. And that was his story. The way he explained his story, coupled with these messages here, do not paint a very positive picture of Michael Elgin. Elgin doesn't really come off as the classiest guy to begin with, if you remember the story he told on the Kevin Steen show many years ago, which I will not recap here. I know some of you are aware of the story I'm talking about. I don't have a lot of sympathy for the guy, and he's losing a ton of bookings now as a result of all this. I saw Smash Wrestling and this other promotion called Limitless Wrestling. They canceled his upcoming bookings. AIW says they're not going to use him going forward. He is still with New Japan. I don't foresee that changing. I guess, this is probably a situation where New Japan probably won't do anything about this. So he still has that gig, at least for now. But A lot of other people are abandoning him. They don't want to be associated with him. They don't want to have anything to do with him. They don't want him on their shows because they see the same thing that I see, which this guy comes across as a real scuzzball, and they don't want to be associated with it. Now, if this student of his did do what this woman alleges, then he deserves to be outed and blackballed, and I hope he is. That's the Michael Elgin situation. As far as I know, he's still off of Twitter. Maybe he'll end up back there at some point and he can speak to some of these messages, but guy doesn't come off in a very positive light, to say the least. I just think in his actions, you know, quickly selling off his promotion and disappearing, you know, if I was advising somebody who was caught in a similar type of situation, those are not things that I would advise them to do. And if Elgin is doing this on his own, he's not doing himself any favors. He should get advice from somebody who actually knows what they're talking about, because right now he's the way he's behaving, he's not doing himself any favors. Adam, in Brisbane, Australia, sent in an audio question. So let's see what Adam has to say.
Yo, Solomonster, it's Ben the Brogue Topless from Brisbane in Australia here. Taking the WrestleMania 19 roster, pitch a Elimination Chamber match to unify both belts using just the roster that was on that show. So, obviously, Brock has to be in it because he won the Rumble. Triple H was the world champion, and Kurt Angle was the WWE champion. I want to hear who you would pick for the other three, because I think the roster was stacked, and you can include Goldberg because he debuted the next night.
So he wants me to book a six-man Elimination Chamber match using the people that were on the WrestleMania 19 roster, and he says I can include Goldberg if I want to. Well, I'm not going to include Goldberg because it would be his first match, and you don't put Goldberg in an Elimination Chamber match in his first match in the company, especially if he's not going to win. Austin and Rock, I would leave as a separate match where they are. Undertaker was kind of lower on the card, honestly. I mean, you could always plug him into a main event, but he was lower on the card at this point. Him and Big Show, they were sort of doing their thing. I'd leave them alone. I would put Booker T, who was feuding with Triple H, Chris Jericho, and Shawn Michaels. I would put those three guys in there with Kurt Angle, Brock Lesnar, and Triple H, with Lesnar winning the unified title. Jay, from the UK. After watching WrestleMania 25 and witnessing the mundane match between Randy Orton and Triple H, I've noticed a lot of manias where Triple H is in the closing match are considered lackluster shows. WrestleMania 16, 18, 22, 25, and 32 are, in my opinion, average WrestleManias, in part because of the closing match. Why did Triple H... why did WWE, I should say, continue to put Triple H in the main event? Do you really need to ask? Is that even a question? Come on. Come on, Jay. You're smarter than that. You do bring up an interesting point, though. I was thinking about this after I read your question. Triple H, really, when you think about it, has never had a standout, great main event match at WrestleMania that did not involve other people. So, like, WrestleMania 16, actually, the WrestleMania 16 match wasn't all that great anyway, and that had four guys in it. That was disappointing. WrestleMania 18, the match with Chris Jericho, that was disappointing. And part of that, well, there's two reasons for that. Number one, the dumb storyline built around Lucy the dog, and putting that match on after Hogan Rock, that match just did not stand a chance. So, it turned out to be a disappointment. Even when Triple H gave Stephanie the pedigree at the end, like, the reaction wasn't what I'm sure they expected it to be. So that was a colossal disappointment. WrestleMania 20 had that excellent triple threat match with Michaels and Benoit, but it was Shawn Michaels and Chris Benoit, right? You'd have to try real hard to have a bad match with those two involved. The match with Batista at WrestleMania 21 did big business, but it was maybe the worst of the three pay-per-view matches the two of them had that year. WrestleMania 22 with Cena in Chicago, you know, that might be the exception. I remember that being pretty good. I liked that match. I didn't think it was a great match, but I remembered liking it. I think the crowd really helped make that match feel special. They shat all over Cena. They were almost fully behind Triple H. It made for a very interesting dynamic, so I might have to make that the exception, but WrestleMania 23, had he not been hurt, had he not torn his other quad, he would have been in that main event against John Cena. And I'd say there's a pretty good chance he probably would have won. Would have gotten his win back. The WrestleMania 25 match with Orton was disappointing. Again, placement on the show played a role in that. Putting that on after Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker was death for those two guys. So that turned out to be a disappointment. And WrestleMania 32 with Roman Reigns, you know, they had a match that I thought was duller than dishwater. WrestleMania 20 is easily the best WrestleMania main event that he's ever been involved in. But when you really look at his track record of WrestleMania main events, so I'm not counting, and when I say main events, I'm talking final match on the show. So I'm not counting the Hell in a Cell match with The Undertaker at 28, which was pretty good. I thought the match with Brock sucked at 29. I thought the match with Sting was a fun trip down nostalgia lane, having DX come out and the NWO come out, all the bells and whistles and stuff. As a match, though, it really wasn't anything special. That was not the match I was hoping for Sting to have once he finally debuted in the company, let alone to lose. I'm trying to think, like, the match he had with Rollins this year, I don't think the match he had with Rollins this year was bad. I think they had a pretty good match, but it wasn't the main event, so I'm not counting that either. So yeah, I mean, when you really look at main events, 20 was the best that involved him. 22, I don't think was a bad match. But he doesn't really have a sterling record of great WrestleMania main events. You know, you're right. You're right about that. It's actually pretty lackluster. Russ from Roselle, I just listened to your passionate rant from last week about how poorly booked the 2015 Royal Rumble match was. In your opinion, is that the worst booked Royal Rumble match of all time? Yes. You know what? It's either that one or 1999. I am torn on which one is the worst. I hate 99, I will say, though, at least gave us Austin and McMahon at different junctures of the match, like at the beginning and the end, and the crowd ate it up. It was always fun to see Stone Cold kicking the crap out of Vince McMahon. We got a little bit of that in that Rumble match. But they sent those two out there at number one and number two, and then they left the ring for almost the entire match. And in between, we got a bunch of mid-carders that nobody cared about because they were all waiting for Austin and Vince to come back. Nobody cared about draws or fucking Goldust with the ball gag in his mouth or the headbangers or any of these other, you know, losers that they sent out there. Nobody cared. It was a waste of a Rumble match. I hated it. I remember nothing else from that Royal Rumble match, aside from one guy after another coming out that I just did not give a shit about. 2015 was just pro wrestling malpractice, how they eliminated Bryan and Ambrose and Ziggler, all the names that people cared about seeing. I mean, it wasn't just Daniel Bryan. I mean, they really just, you know, they turned on that match something fierce when he got eliminated. But they actually did come alive when Ambrose came out and when Ziggler came out. There was hope. There were actually other people that the people cared about. And it was the way in which they were eliminated. It was the way in which they were knocked off the apron or dumped out of the ring by Kane and Big Show. It was like one giant fuck you to the audience. That's what that Royal Rumble match was. It was one giant fuck you to the fans. And the fans had every right to shit all over it the way they did. And there were just so many opportunities where had they just position things differently, book things differently, kept certain guys in longer until the end, it actually could have made for a pretty compelling finish, because I think a big part of why that match really shit the bed so early was once Bryan got knocked off the apron the way he did by Bray Wyatt, people were upset, but it also made the outcome of the match, I mean, the outcome was never in doubt. The outcome was probably never in doubt anyway, but once Bryan was gone, that was it. So I don't even know why you wouldn't want to keep him in there longer, knowing that no matter what you do, the people are going to boo this man. If it comes down to Bryan and Roman at the end, yeah, you're setting yourself up for, you know, a rebellion. If he eliminates Bryan, you're not going to get the big babyface reaction that you're looking for. Did they honestly think they were going to get that anyway? I mean, seriously, the mindset was we'll get rid of Bryan early and let them get it all out of their system, and by the end, it'll be fine. Did they honestly believe, I can't believe that, in their mind, that they honestly thought that that's the way it would go. But apparently they did. I'm not sure why you wouldn't want to keep Bryan in there longer, just to keep people thinking, hey, wait a minute, you know, who's going to win? Maybe Brian will win. Maybe they learned their lesson from last year when he wasn't even in the Rumble. And now, maybe it'll be Daniel Bryan winning and not Roman Reigns. Once Bryan went out, that was it. Everything else was just, like I said, it was almost like a slap in the face every time one of those guys was literally picked up and dumped out like a sack of garbage. So, it's a hard thing, like, which was worse? I didn't like either one of them. But, no drama whatsoever with that 2015 match. Just 15,000 pissed off people shitting all over the match, and rightfully so. I didn't see people shitting all over the Rumble in 99, because everybody was so friggin' over back then, especially Austin and Vince. I mean, they were a hell of a lot more over than almost anybody on the roster today. So, you know, it's not like the fans turned on the match or anything like that. So I go as far as to say, yeah, 2015 probably was. Probably was the worst Royal Rumble match of all time. Let's see. Brianna from Jackson, Mississippi. On a scale of 1 to 10, where would you rank the year 1997 in WWE? I know business wasn't great and the company was near bankruptcy, but from a storyline standpoint, I think 97 is one of the more underrated years in company history. You have the rise of the Nation of Domination and The Rock, the rise of Stone Cold Steve Austin, a great rekindled feud between Bret and Austin, the formation of DX, and we had a fantastic WWE title scene featuring Undertaker, Austin, Bret, Shawn, and Sid Vicious all vying for the title. Not to mention the very first Hell in a Cell match, Kane's debut, and you could even throw in all of the real-life drama between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. Well, you just made my case for me. I was going to mention all of the things that you just mentioned, and now I can't. No, 97 is one of their best years, creatively. Business-wise, like you said, they flirted with the idea of bankruptcy. So, yeah, business-wise, when you're flirting with the idea of bankruptcy, that ain't a good year. Their fortunes didn't really start to turn until the fall. That's when things started to finally go their way. And they moved to 3-hour pay-per-views every single month, and they jacked up the pay-per-view price. And wouldn't you know, it didn't chase people away. It actually got people to spend more money on their shows. It's funny how that works. And so they were making more money. And I mean, that's really the whole story. If you think back to the Montreal thing, it was Vince who went to Bret and said, look, I can't pay you on this contract. You know, if you're not willing to sort of backload the contract or defer some of the money, which Bret said he wouldn't do, I can't pay you. I'm going to breach your contract. I'm giving you permission to go negotiate with Ted Turner and Eric Bischoff. And after all of the negotiations and after a deal had already been agreed to, only then, once Vince said, hey, wait a minute, all of a sudden we got enough money coming in, he went back to Bret and said, look, I can afford to pay you now. And Bret said, well, it's too late. The deal is done. So just to give you a little perspective on that timeline as a little aside there. But creatively, I think 97 was one of their best years, without question. And they didn't need an army of 28 writers either. Right? I mean, think about who they would have had back then. Obviously Vince, probably Patterson, Russo, Cornette, I think, might have been helping creatively. That was probably it. That was probably the core right there of the people who were putting the product together that we saw on TV every single week. The real-life drama helped, for sure. I think it brought out the worst, but it also brought out the best in those guys with Bret and Shawn. I love how everything revolved around the championship in like the end of 96, beginning of 97, everything revolved around the title. Now, you would never even know that there was a title on Raw. Roman Reigns is the de facto top champion on Monday Night Raw. Now, you also forgot to mention, I would throw in the ECW invasion in 97, the stuff like the great debate on TV between Jerry Lawler and Paul Heyman I thought was great. The Canada versus U.S. angle I thought was smart. Nothing like turning two countries against each other for, you know, great TV. So on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the best, I'd probably go 8 or 9. I still think 2000 was WWE's best year, but I'd have no problem going with that and 97 as my 1-2 punch. Davis from Tempe, Arizona. A couple of weeks back, you pitched a scenario for 2001-2002 where Bret Hart returns to WWE after WCW was bought out, leading to a match with Kurt Angle at WrestleMania 18. Let's say Bret stays for a couple more years after that. How do you think that would have affected Shawn Michaels' return in mid-2002? Would Shawn have even come back for his second run? Oh, I'm sure he would have. I don't... I don't envision a scenario where Bret Hart comes back to WWE, forgives Vince McMahon for what happened, and has an issue with them bringing in Shawn Michaels. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Now, I think the way I pitched it was, if Montreal never happened, then Bret would have come back, and so we're kind of operating under the assumption, I think, that what happened in 97 did not happen. So I don't see him having any issue working with Shawn. Shawn would have come back. I don't think Bret's situation had anything to do with Shawn. I mean, when Shawn felt he was ready to physically come back, he came back. And I have no doubt in my mind that, had Bret come back and had the match with Kurt and had a few other matches, that we would have ended up having a Bret Hart-Shawn Michaels match probably at a WrestleMania. I don't know if it would have been WrestleMania 19. I don't know if it would have been maybe another pay-per-view. Not a doubt in my mind that we would have gotten Bret and Shawn. And it's a real and that would have been, I mean, even if you take away what happened in Montreal, everybody knew the bad blood between them in 97. It would not have taken a lot of effort, I think, to sort of rekindle that. That would have been something. A Bret-Shawn match in, let's say, 02 or 03. And Bret, physically, had he not been kicked in the head and had the stroke, he would have been, how old would he have been? 50-ish, maybe? Yeah, he would have been older at that point, but I think he still would have been in pretty good shape. Shawn, when he first came back in 02, was in pretty good shape. I mean, he got another 8 years out of it. So I think the two of them could have gone out there and had maybe the best match they've ever had. You know, when I've heard Bret do interviews where he's talked about the match with Shawn at Survivor Series, he goes, it's a real shame because he and I had this great match laid out and we were having a great match. He goes, when the sharpshooter spot happened, we had like another whole match planned. Like there was still another like 10 or 15 minutes left in the match after that sharpshooter spot. And he said it's a shame because he felt like, had they seen that match to its conclusion, it probably would have gone down as the best in-ring match the two of them ever had. And when you look back at the matches they did have, Survivor Series 92, I thought was a really good match. I wouldn't call it an all-time classic, but it was pretty good. The match they had at WrestleMania 12, people are going to look at that and go, oh, it's an all-time classic. I guess it is a classic because it was the first one, right, that they ever did, the first Iron Man match, that they promoted. But you guys know my thoughts on that. I think that's a very overrated match. It's good, but not nearly as good as people make it out to be. And then you have the Survivor Series 97 match. Bret and Shawn really did not have a lot of singles matches together. So I think that, if they were healthy and Shawn comes back, the two of them absolutely have a match. And I think they probably would have ended up having the best match that they've ever had together. So it's a real shame that we never got to see that. You look at Shawn and The Undertaker. Both of them were a lot older. This was 2009 when they had that first WrestleMania match. I don't know that, it's tough because I still look at that match at WrestleMania 25. As being the best WrestleMania match of all time. That's my personal pick. Not that you could go wrong picking, like Bret and Austin at WrestleMania 13. I mean, there's lots of different options. I choose Shawn and Undertaker. But they had the Hell in a Cell match in 97. Obviously, that was an outstanding match. Shawn and Undertaker, you could argue, had their best match ever in 2009. Long after they had their first matches in 97, over a decade later. They were both a lot older. And they still went out there and had the kind of match that they had at WrestleMania 25 and WrestleMania 26. I mean, I don't think 26 was as good, but it was close. And they did that years later. So I don't have a doubt in my mind that if Bret Hart stays healthy, him and Shawn in 2003, 2005, 2008, could have gone out there and torn the house down and had the best match that the two of them have ever had. It's one of the many matches with Bret that unfortunately we never really got the chance to see. Like him and Kurt, like him and... I'm trying to think of who else I would have wanted to see Bret, like from the current roster. I guess Bret and Cena would have been a given. But I always wanted to see Bret and Kurt. Bret and Brock, when Brock actually knew more than three moves. I think those would have been pretty great matches. Andrew in Arkansas, buy or sell? The Ric Flair versus Dusty Rhodes Starrcade series, or the series of matches between Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat from 1989? Ooh, it's a good one. I can't sell on Flair Steamboat from 89. So I'm going to buy on that. Sell on Starcade. And we'll end with Zach from West Virginia. You mentioned that you were wrapping up watching season 3 of Narcos. We all know how much you love Breaking Bad. So buy or sell, Escobar or Heisenberg? I did finish Narcos, by the way. Great show. I highly recommend it. I binged the final 4 episodes in one night. I'm thinking of moving on to House of Cards next. Everybody keeps telling me, oh, you'll love that show. You should really get into it. It's really good. Kevin Spacey is an asshole, but don't worry about it. So I'm thinking that maybe the next one I move on to, but I'm kind of stuck now on old episodes of Law & Order SVU. I'm taking full advantage of this Netflix app on my phone. You have no idea how boring my commute is to work when I go to work and I come home. So the fact that the Netflix app has offline downloading is awesome. I don't think Hulu does. I don't think HBO Go does. That sucks. So I've been browsing around on Netflix, and I've become addicted now to SVU episodes. So that's my latest vice. Anyway, to answer your question, Escobar at his peak would have eaten Walter White's lunch. It's not even a contest. There's not even a comparison. And I'm a big Walter White fan. Breaking Bad, I love that show. I think it may be the greatest show of all time. Not even a comparison, though, between the two characters. I mean, for God's sakes, Pablo Escobar, the man had his own private prison built so he could serve his sentence there. Okay? Doesn't get any more boss than that. Yeah, I'll serve my prison sentence. I'm going to build my own prison. That's what he did. I thought, you know, like, I knew a little bit about Escobar before the show, but I didn't want to read up on him because I didn't want to, like, spoil, like, who dies or, like, when they die, and then I'm looking for it when I watch the show. So I'm like, you know what, when the show is over and I finished it, I'll go back and I'll look at his Wikipedia and I'll read up on the guy, and it's amazing. Like, so a lot of the things on the show, they really tried to stay true to life, and he actually did that. I don't think Walter White could have built his own prison to serve his sentence. And his operation, Escobar's operation, was far bigger than anything that Heisenberg did. He had an entire city in his back pocket. Everybody was paid off. He had eyes and ears everywhere. You couldn't make a move without him knowing what you were doing, what you were eating for breakfast. That's power. That's power. So I don't think it's fair to compare. Obviously, I'm going to buy on Escobar, but I don't even think it's fair to compare the two of them. Keep voting in the Wrestling Radio Awards, WrestlingRadioAwards.com. Nominations are still open. You can, of course, follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. We do have a pay-per-view coming up next Sunday, Clash of Champions, the final pay-per-view of 2017. I will have my predictions. Probably going to get the podcast up. Well, we'll see. I have to record it a day early. We'll see if I get it up early. I'll probably get it up Sunday morning. So if anything, it'll go up a few hours earlier next Sunday. We'll have predictions for the show. That night, as always, on YouTube, I'll have a review up of the pay-per-view a few hours after it's over. So that'll be fun next weekend, and all the other wrestling news stories of the week, your mailbag questions, all the good stuff that you come to expect here from this show. I guess this will be, what is this going to be, the third to last episode of the Sound Off for 2017? Something like that? We don't have a lot left. We don't have a lot left, but as of January 1st, I've officially entered my 11th year of doing this show. I'm officially old. I feel old. I'm not really that old, but I feel old. Anyway, I'll see you guys next week. And until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a much better week than Rich Swann is having. And I will see you next Sunday for more Sound Off. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
And there was one moron who tagged me in a tweet. He says, Smarks like everything from Japan. This guy has a picture of The Rock as his avatar, and he's quoting wrestling catchphrases on his timeline, calling other people Marks and Smarks when you've got another man as your profile picture and you're quoting Psycho Sid. Sit the fuck down with that nonsense. You don't get to sit at the adult table when you spew nonsense like that. Go stand in the corner and face the wall.
Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.